All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Hey, welcome once again to Veterans Radio. Bob Gould, your host today, bringing you Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WAAM, 1600 on your AM dial, right here in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. We got a good show today. We're going to be talking about the Forgotten War, World War One. I say that, folks, because I know so little about that, and I think most people do, too. It's just not something that was really covered in the history, but a little bit. But we're going to be talking about that with Kevin Hemel and John McManus, who are regulars on our program, and they will be with us in just a moment. But first, we got a couple of announcements. Hire the Vet Day, Preparation Day for veterans and their families. It's a hiring event, Michigan, November 3rd. At 10 o'clock at the Washtenaw Community College, starts at 10 o'clock. It's going to be hiring the vets. It's going to be resume preparation, mock interviewing, haircuts. Ooh, yeah, I should probably go there. Provided on-site by Karma Hair Studio. It's going to be all kinds of good folks there to give you a hand. It's free. It's called the Prep Day Info. Michigan Works are the folks that are putting this on. That's Friday, October the 21st. And that, oh, there's two of them. That's okay. That's going to be at Michigan Works Friday, October 21st. And again, the hiring Michigan vet at Washtenaw Community College is going to be November the 3rd. So I guess they're both at Washtenaw Community College. You're going to want to do that. Hire the veteran. Why do you want to hire the veteran? Because they show up. They do their job. They do what they're told. And they don't take time off. Sounds good. Hire the veteran. Second thing, on the list today, we've got the World War II Legacy Memorial. It's being set up in Plymouth, Michigan. And there's going to be a fundraiser win on Thursday, October 13th. That's just about 2 weeks, right? No, not quite, about 10 days. It's going to be at the Royal Oak Farmers Market. Your host is going to be Guy Gordon. He's going to be the master of ceremonies. Doors open at 5:30. Once again, that's Thursday, October 13th. Doors open at 5:30 at the Royal Oak Farmers Market. There is a charge because it's a fundraiser, folks. It's $100. It's for the, that's right. And there will be strolling musicians. There's going to be a DJ. There's going to be a talk from John Teagan, who is the Benghazi hero, and he's a author or co-author of 13 Hours. And he will be giving a little talk, and then, of course, Guy Gordon. And there's going to be a silent auction. There's going to be some food, so that's at the Royal Oak Farmers Market on Thursday, October the 13th. Dale Thronberry will have a little bit more next week. Cool. A lot of cool stuff happening. Okay, well, here we are. And I have with me in the studio, he's looking right at me. I don't know if he's looking down. He's got a great smile. I met this gentleman the other day, and it was just a great opportunity to meet somebody who works with veterans. And not only that, but he works with disabled veterans. Right now, I want to introduce Gerald Hoff from the University of Michigan Health System. He's the founder and organizer of the U of M Army, Navy, go Army, wheelchair basketball game. Gerald, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. And I'd like to tell everyone about this great event.
I know you do. Well, just you're here in the studio, which makes it very, very interesting that you and I can be back and forth. But let's get started on this. Okay, so you've got this wheelchair. Well, who's playing?
Well, we have a number of veterans that are U of M veterans, and we have that are going to be playing in the game. We have some Paralympians that are playing in the game. We have a number of ROTC folks that are playing in the game. We actually have 26 players on both teams.
What time does this start?
The tip-off is at 3, but our DJ is going to start at 2. So we'd like for folks to come early because we got one of the best DJs around that's going to start.
And you're going to be playing all kinds of nice, World War II, Vietnam, music, what? It's just going to be, we're going to have everything covered, right, Jerry?
We have music for everyone We have the 338th Army Band that's going to be there. So 20 members of the 338th Army Band are going to play all the military music that you'd ever want to hear.
Now this starts, this is next week, right?
Going to be October 9th. The doors open at 2, and that's at the U of M Chrysler Center.
Okay.
And the tip-off.
Folks know where that is, right? Yeah, right. That's where they play basketball. Is there any charge?
No charge.
How about for parking?
No charge.
No.
Yeah, that's.
You pick up the parking too.
We got it covered.
Okay, so the parking's covered. The entry, there is none. And is it only open for veterans?
Everybody can come. Bring your family, your friends, your neighbors. Help spread the word. This is one of the few events that there is no charge that you'll ever attend in your life and in my life. And,
I know.
You can't beat that.
Oh, well, I want to thank you for doing that because it makes it very convenient for folks. Remember, that's next Sunday at Chrysler Arena. Tip-off is at 3 o'clock, but they'd like you there a little bit earlier to hear the music, to hear the bands. And will they have a chance to meet the players perhaps after the game or before the game?
Sure. They may be hanging around a little bit after some of the players. And there's other entertainment besides the music, too, because we have all 30 young ladies of the University of Michigan dance team.
Oh, yeah.
That will perform. And also the University of Michigan cheer team will be there to perform, too. And they took the national title, I think, 3 years in a row now.
This is a real pack up the babies and grab the old ladies and grandmas and grandpas and everybody else to come to Chrysler Arena next week.
That's
3
right.
3 o'clock. But don't get there because that's the time that the game starts. You want to get there at 2.
Yes.
And the parking, there's no charge for parking. There's
no charge
to get in.
No charge.
And if you got 12 kids, you can bring them all, right?
That's right. The more the merrier. I'd like to find someone that has about 20. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, looking here now, and who is going to be the Grand Marshal?
The Grand Marshal is Ted Spencer. He's an Air Force veteran, and he is a senior advisor on admissions outreach at the University of Michigan. And prior to that, he was the U of M Associate Provost and Executive Director of Undergraduate Admissions.
And he's going to be the?
He's the Grand Marshal.
And what does Grand Marshal do?
Well, we recognize him in his service. And so he's we feel that he's a very important figure in the community with our student veterans and just in general. And Ted is just an amazing person. And so if you attend the game, there might be a good chance of meeting Ted.
Now, I always remember when I was a kid, the Army-Navy game, football, was always a big deal. I mean, huge Army-Navy. And that's kind of fallen by the wayside because the programs just can't seem to, get the recruits they do. But this Army-Navy can be a real challenge. Tell us about that.
Oh, this Army-Navy game, I'm going to tell you what, the players are extremely serious about this. Yeah, so when that ball drops, it's on. And they'll really go at it. And we really have some really high-caliber players that will play in the game, so it won't be boring. There'll be some scoring. There'll be plenty.
Oh, I've seen wheelchair basketball. Yeah. That's
there'll be a lot of contact, but there'll be a lot
I've
of scoring,
I've seen them knock
too.
Each other down.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of contact and a lot of scoring. Yeah. Are there special rules?
Well, for this game, this particular game, we're not going to call it real tight. Okay, so we kind of let some of the rules go. So it won't be called real close. So there'll be more contact than usual because this is an Army-Navy game. And, so we kind of let some of the some of the rules slide a little bit and let the players play.
Now, folks, there's going to be non-disabled veterans playing at the same time. So they'll be mixed with the wheelchair guys. Is that right?
That's Jerry? Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's kind of keep things more. About approximately how long does the game go?
Well, we have around a 20-minute first half and then a 25-minute halftime. And then we do a second half is going to be 20 minutes. But with the entertainment that we have, they'll perform throughout the game. It's going to be just a little bit longer than that because we want to give the dance team time to go out and really perform. And we want to give the 338th band time to perform Dogface, if you're familiar with that.
No.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite tunes.
What's Dogface?
Oh, yeah. I love it. And you want to give the DJ also an opportunity to get, you know, do his thing, too.
So, and will there be concessions like pop and hot dogs? And those you're going to purchase, right?
Yes. Yeah, there will be a concession that's open there.
Yes. So, but the entry and the parking is, and that's hard, folks. Parking in Ann Arbor. It's no charge. So how do they get more information?
Well, they can actually go to a website.
That called?
Well, that would be if you do wheelchair basketball at the University of Michigan. There should be a website that you'll be able to
Google
go to.
Google that, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Google that, and they should be. You could do the wheelchair basketball or the University of Michigan Army Navy wheelchair basketball game. If you Google that, you're going to pull up a lot of information on that game.
Okay, folks. Now, this is not the first game. Is that right, Jerry?
That's correct. This is actually the 11th year for wheelchair basketball at the University of Michigan. I've put on all the games for U of M. This is the 7th year for the Army-Navy game, and we've had some really great grand marshals, too.
What's the how many wins for Army, how many wins for Navy? Do you know that offhand?
Well, I'll tell you, that Navy had a streak going. Army took it last year. Navy had 3 games in a row going, and then before that, Army was able to pull off the first year. But then Navy kind of took over for a while and dominated.
Oh, well, we'll have to change that this particular weekend. So once again, it's the Army-Navy Battle of the Schools, Army-Navy wheelchair basketball game next Sunday. The tip-off is at 3, but, boy, get there at 2 o'clock because the parking's free. Bring the family. Bring everybody. Have hot dogs and pop and go out and see this great event and all the cheerleaders and Jerry will be there and we hope to see you all there. Jerry, you got one last comment. Go ahead and say something.
You'll never attend another event that this has this kind of entertainment ever. It just doesn't happen. The 338th Army Band, you have the DJ Scholar that's going to perform. You have the dance team. You have the cheer team. And you're going to watch a great event.
Will it be on television, perhaps? Cable. There you go.
No, I believe it was 1 year. They did get it on 1 year, but it isn't going to be on this year. Nobody has contacted me about that.
Okay. Well, once again, Gerald Hoff. He's the founder and organizer of the U of M Army-Navy wheelchair basketball game. Jerry, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. And we'd like you, perhaps, to come back again in the next, maybe a month or so, and tell us a little bit more of how you got involved with all this. Okay, will you come back?
Well, thank you very much. I definitely would. I'd love to.
Well, that's it, folks. Okay, we'll be right back right after this very important message with Kevin Hemel and John McManus, as we'll be talking about World War I. Okay, we're back on the band. They got a little extra beat in there. We're talking right now with Kevin Hemel and John McManus. Two historians have been on our program many, many times. We're going to be talking about World War I. I call it the Forgotten War, or we never really knew about it, and we didn't cover that. And when I was in school, not much at all, if anything, other than just the dates and such. And And so today we're going to take a little look at it. It's one of a series that I'll be presenting on it, but I want to get some background, especially on the leaders. So we're going to be focusing on a little bit of historical background, but mostly about the leaders on the American side. Welcome, Kevin, and welcome, John, to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob.
John, they got you there?
Yeah, how's it going, Bob?
All right, good. Okay, well, both you gentlemen, here we go. Kevin, no, I'm going to go with John first.
Oh!
No, I know, but I just have to figure this out, how this whole thing got started. A world war brought everybody in, and folks, keep in mind that prior to that, it was just a few years prior to that, there was no internal combustion engine. There were no tanks. There was no airplane at that time. There were no airplanes, so that they hadn't even 8 years before, they hadn't even had the first. And here, all these things played a very important part, but so did the leaders. John, tell us about this Austrian-Hungarian Empire. What were all these factions that were coming together?
Yeah, what had happened is that you'd had decades of imperial rivalry from many of Europe's leading empires. Austria-Hungary, of course, a newly united Germany since the 1870s that was looming as a real threat to the balance of power on the European continent, if not overseas. Obviously, Great Britain, which was the leading empire in the world, Republican France, Tsarist Russia. And the United States is not really a part of this mix. It's much more preoccupied with expansion in the Pacific and doing business in China and so on and so forth. So the irony of this whole thing is that as these countries in Europe became more powerful, they felt less secure. And so they began to pursue alliances with one another in hopes of providing for that security. There was a lot of diplomatic intrigue and alliances. So on the eve of the war, basically as a sort of a lineup, Austria, Hungary, and Germany were allies, and Russia was allied with France formally and Britain informally, and all of which were concerned about the possibility of Germany dominating Europe and Africa and much of the colonial world. So when you have a kind of a local conflict between Austria-Hungary and a small country called Serbia, which had an alliance with Russia because of mutual ethnicity, when war breaks out between Serbia and Austria-Hungary, there's a kind of chain reaction because Russia felt obligated to protect Serbia. Russia didn't like Austria-Hungary either. The Germans then became interested in this and told the Russians to stand down, and they wouldn't. And, of course, then France and Russia were going to stand together, and Britain will end up allied with them eventually. So it was a diplomatic failure of the first order, certainly. But there was also a kind of I won't say a lust for war on the part of many of the leaders in these countries, but certainly an acceptance that war might achieve many of their policy aims. So none of them expected the long, protracted, bloody war that followed, but they did embrace war when it did come.
Now, it ostensibly was started. The spark was a assassination at Sarajevo. Kevin, tell us about that.
Well, it was the Archduke Ferdinand. He was going to an event with his wife, and there were some Serbian rebels in the crowd that had planned their assassination of him. And, in fact, when the assassin stepped out to shoot him, he didn't do too well. He circled around the street, came out and shot him again. And the Archduke was wearing a very stiff and, I guess, well-ironed and pleated uniform. And he said he felt okay, and because of the thickness and the darkness of the uniform, they really couldn't see the blood coming through. So no one realized just how bad it was. But, of course, it later, it takes his life. And it's almost like dominoes falling. It looks very simple looking back, how all these alliances, came into one big clash. And, couldn't they have stopped it? But there was, like John was saying, there was a lot of political momentum that it was almost hard to put the brakes on, and a lot of real nationalism in all these countries that, have been long reporting about insults and flights by other countries. And so this thing just is like a snowball rolling downhill. And exactly like John said, they thought this was going to be a quick solution to a lot of political problems, not a long, drawn-out war that's going to really basically cost an entire generation of Europe.
Now things happened very quickly. War started very, very quickly right after the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand. So we get started, and there's slaughter. There's slaughter on the battlefields. And I know I'm sort of skipping ahead right at this point, but the slaughter on the battlefields when I watch, and I'm sure a lot of other folks when they watch this on television, anything on World War One, we see this mass of humanity come out of the trenches and just attack, and or their attack is en masse, standing up against now machine guns and artillery fire. Kevin, when I was in the Army, you dropped to the prone position, take a couple of shots, you got up and ran 10 more yards and jumped into a foxhole or a shell hole. They didn't do that. What was that all about? Why did they keep going, and who was responsible?
Well, it's really hard to put the response on one person. It's kind of like the same thing in the Civil War, where you have tactics from the last war dictating your tactics in this one. They are obsolete, to make an understatement. But, you know, the belief was, in the initial stages of the war, it was quite a bit mobile, but as the realization of the firepower and the fact that the French almost couldn't go on the offensive, they started digging in, much like you saw in the end of the Civil War with the Siege of Petersburg. But, you know, the belief was that now you have this artillery that's so exact and you can fire over the hill without even looking, that if you prepare the battlefield with artillery, which was a belief dating back to the Napoleonic era, you know, you will crush the enemy enough that your infantry can merely advance and sort of win the day. And, you know, it really was not the case. And, the machine gun makes a big difference because you don't have that sort of rapid fire any time before this. But it's sort of that policy of the previous war of mobility and the trenches don't matter, not being able to catch up with the reality of trench warfare in World War One. And there was this constant belief, and you see this in a lot of wars, where, you know, if we just give it one more push, we can really break through. And, you know, both sides had such multiple trench systems that you can never really crack a line and you know, pour into the enemy's rear. And so it really was just this grind that developed that nobody saw coming.
But wasn't there, after a certain period of time, wasn't there some effort to perhaps change the tactics, or was that just over? That was it. We're just going to do it with this en masse. Was there any attempt at all to do anything different, or that was it? This was going to be trench warfare.
I wouldn't say there was an effort to change. What actually happened, there was a mutiny in the French army. Because we're not going over the top anymore. We'll fight defensively, but we are not doing this. And it basically froze the Allied line, and it lasted for quite a while, yet the Germans never found out about it. And it wasn't until Field Marshal Foch, the French field marshal, comes into power, and he says, you know, we've got to win this war. We're not going to do it this way. And by the time Foch comes around, you know, you've got things like gas on the battlefield, and you've got tanks, and you've got air power making a bit of a difference. So there's these sort of creaking technological advances that are going to make it, I wouldn't say safer, but make it possible to bring some maneuver back to the battlefield. And that's something John J. Pershing was really big with. He was adamant about bringing maneuver warfare back to the battlefield. It wasn't exactly successful initially, but the idea of we need to rush forward, we can do this. You know, the American Army does make some pretty incredible advances during World War One.
Now, but leading up to our involvement, we've got this. Now, this has all started: France, Germany, Russia. But what was the landscape like to get the Germans to have John to have unrestricted submarine warfare? That's what got us into that. What was that all about leading up to that?
Right. There's a lot of things in play. If we're looking at if I might sort of piggyback on the last question, if we're looking at the issue of why there's such a slaughter, and why this goes on in such a protracted way, one of the things we can look at now for a better understanding, is this is an era called the Progressive Era, particularly in the United States. And basically what that means is you're at a point in human history in which technology is really ahead of ideas about how to use it, public policy. For instance, in this country, we were really struggling with child labor, labor issues, slums, overcrowding, the idea of a complete free market versus government oversight, and all these kinds of things also now kind of spill over into the military realm. So you have all these incredible weapons, gas, deadly artillery, which becomes the biggest killer on the battlefield in the 20th century, machine guns, better rifles, air power, you know, all of that. And we're still fighting with old ideas from the 19th century about how to maneuver soldiers. So what it means is that it's, you know, maneuver is not at an end. It's just a matter of how to coordinate with all these new weapons and take all this stuff into account. So both sides will really be working on this quite a bit, and they will devise new tactics. The Germans really better than the Allies. And this also affects sea power, too.
Well, that's... John, hold your thought for a second. We got to take a break right here, and we got about 10 seconds. That's the band. John, we'll be right back with you. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Don't go away. And we're back on Veterans Radio. I have with us today Kevin Hemel and John McManus, both historians, been on the program many, many times, and you've seen both of these gentlemen on the History Channel, the Military Channel, and just about any channel that you can think of, these both of these gentlemen have been on. We're right now, we're talking about World War One. We're talking about unrestricted submarine warfare because they sank, John, they sank a civilian ship. Tell us about that, and how did that get America into the war?
Right. One of the things that had led to the war in the first place was a naval arms race between Britain and Germany. Britain, of course, being the preeminent naval power in the world, Germany wanting to threaten that. And the supreme irony of this whole thing is as much money and capital treasure that, you know, they, both sides have spent on these powerful surface fleets. Within the first year or so, submarines are very well in play and proving to be some of the deadliest and most effective ships, at least strategically, in terms of severing the enemy's economic lifeline. So what the Germans were trying to do is strangle Great Britain, cut it off from its colonies, and thus bring Britain to its knees that way. And the way they're going to do that is unrestricted submarine warfare, which means regardless of whether you're flying the flag of a neutral ship, if this is a ship that's helping Great Britain and the Allies, it is a fair target. So we will attack it without warning. Well, the most famous instance of this, of course, is the sinking of the Lusitania off the southern coast of Ireland on May 7, 1915, and 128 Americans were killed. At that point, there's a lot of international blowback, including here in the U.S., against Germany for the so-called barbarism of unrestricted submarine warfare. The Germans back off then for about a year or so, but then decide this isn't getting us anywhere, and it really wasn't, because basically the U.S. and other neutrals were helping the Allies without actually being in the war, you know, sending them food and weaponry and whatever. So the Germans re-implemented unrestricted submarine warfare towards the end of 1916, and it's at that point that you really see an inevitable collision course for the U.S. being in the war, because U.S. ships were sunk with American loss of life, which in turn puts enormous pressure on Woodrow Wilson's administration to get into the war on the Allied side, and this is precisely what happens in April 1917.
Okay, let's go to April 1917. The U.S. is getting involved, Kevin. Now they're in there, and we're going to kind of fast forward to a couple of leaders, future leaders for World War II, but here they were just getting started in their careers, and that would be General George S. Patton and, of course, General MacArthur. Kevin, tell us about Patton and his role in World War I. What all happened?
Well, Patton was actually on General Pershing, John J. Pershing's staff, Pershing being the number one commander of all American troops going into Europe and fighting the war. And he's on his staff, and he actually works his motor pool and finds out about this new weapon called a tank. And he's offered the opportunity to either command an infantry regiment or work in this sort of, you know, fledgling tank, idea. And he chooses to go with the tanks. He is basically the leader of a light tank unit. He trains them. He creates the documents for it, all the training manuals, the doctrine. He goes and watches tanks being built so he can understand them better. And then he's going to lead them on the battlefield for the first time in September of 1918. This is the Battle of Saint-Mihiel. And he's supporting the 42nd Infantry Division. And Saint-Mihiel is a bulge in the German, bulge in the Allied line, almost kind of looks like the Battle of the Bulge, but it's a static one. And so he's going to be pushing from the south north to meet up with French troops pushing down. And he sends his tanks off. It had rained the night before. It's very muddy. Communications break down. So he moves forward, and he gets to the top of a hill. And as he starts to come down, he bumps into Brigadier General Douglas MacArthur. And so there's Patton, and he's got his ivory-handled pistols that will become famous in another war. And there's Douglas MacArthur, who's wearing a scarf that his mother knitted him that he's going to wear all the way through World War II and Korea. And they start looking at a map together and discussing things. And while they're doing that, an artillery barrage, a German artillery barrage, starts marching towards them. So what you would do is, you know, you fire your artillery at a certain location, and then you fire a little further, a little further, a little further, and you try to keep it up ahead of your infantry to help them advance. And so once this happens, everybody hits the deck except for MacArthur and Patton. They stand there looking at the map, discussing it. Patton wrote about it that night, and he said neither Douglas MacArthur or I really cared what the other one was saying. We were both kind of had our eyes on that artillery barrage, but neither one of us were about to duck. Patton finds out that some of his tankers are afraid to cross a bridge into a town called Tens. So he actually gets down and walks across the bridge to prove that it's not mine. He then climbs on a tank, takes it into the town, jumps off of it, chases a few Germans into a house, as well as the other gentlemen from the tank. They do the same. Then he climbs back on, and they're rolling out of the town, and all of a sudden he notices the paint chipping off the side of the tank and comes to realize the Germans are using a machine gun and firing at him. So he jumps off the side of the tank. The tank continues on. It doesn't hear him yelling, you know, hey, I fell, you know, I'm off. And he realizes, he says, I can't walk backwards. I can't let people see me retreating. And that's something that is going to be prominent in World War II also. So what he does is he gets up and runs sideways and a little bit backwards and then drops and continues that because the machine gun has to stop. And every time he realizes the machine gun stopped, he jumps up and runs a little bit more, but has to do it at an angle so that the men around him will not think that he's retreating. And, you know, he finishes the day and reports to his superior, who's very upset with Patton because he said, you know, hey, you weren't supposed to go up front. You were supposed to stay back and coordinate and be on the radio with me. And that's another thing that will symbolize Patton in the future, his willingness, in fact, enthusiasm to be up front with the troops.
Now, but I just want to go back a little bit because there was a point when Patton was a young lieutenant, right? And against Pancho Villa, and didn't he get on a jeep and well, tell us about that, Kevin.
Sure, this was before World War I, and this was sort of a really good training period for the U.S. Army pursuing Pancho Villa because it kind of showed how everything can fall apart on the offensive. But he gets the idea to pursue one of his lieutenants, a guy named Cardenas, and they were in two cars going out for food supplies, and Patton passed Cardenas' uncle's ranch and says, you know, hey, I think we can capture this guy. I bet he's in there. So what he does is he has the two cars race to the house. One would pull up front, the other one would go out back, and they, you know, it's basically a primitive pincer movement. And so him and his soldiers did that. There were about seven altogether, and Patton was in the vehicle that came around the back of the house, and three guys on horseback come out of the house, the big ranch, and they start shooting at him, and he's shooting at them, and he's got his single ivory-handled Colt revolver with him. I'm sorry, it was his Magnum, I believe. And he runs out of bullets. He hits one of them, hits the horse, and he has to duck sort of behind a corner to reload. And he said all this clay dust was sprinkling on him, and he swore he'd never carry a single pistol into combat again. But he then jumped back out, fired more rounds. They killed all three guys off of the horses. And it's sort of confirmation that they got the right guys. The bodies on their horses, they had blankets, army blankets, that said 13th Cavalry, and that was the unit that had been attacked in Columbus in the United States when Pancho Villa raided across the border. So Pat knew he got his man, and in fact, his Colt 45, his Magnum, in the Patton Museum at Fort Knox, has two notches in the handle that he made from the shootout with the banditos.
Oh, what a remarkable man, and that was a remarkable story. And in fact, it sounds a little bit like he was using very, very rudimentary tank tactics the way he approached that particular event.
Yeah.
So
and you know, that's the first time that the American Army used a motorized vehicle in combat, that action in Mexico, and that was Patton's idea.
Think of this, folks. I mean, think of these leaders in World War II. Here they are. They're young in their careers, and yet they had that. They had the grit, they had the fervor, and they had the vision as to how to win. That was really something. But that, John, that gets us to the next big ego, huge ego, bigger than the Goodyear blimp, everything else altogether. MacArthur and his layers of myth surrounding him. John, tell us about that.
Right. I like to say that maybe on a good day, the Grand Canyon might be able to hold Douglas MacArthur's ego. MacArthur was the son of a very prominent general who had the sort of funny name of Arthur MacArthur. Arthur was a Civil War hero who had earned the Medal of Honor, and he ends up as the American commanding general in the Philippine-American War in the early 20th century. Douglas was his younger son, and he attended West Point, and you know, is a guy who, through the sponsorship of his mother and father, but especially his mother, who did a lot of networking for him with officers throughout the Army, Douglas becomes this kind of fair-haired boy with a lot of advantages and a sort of coming leader in the Army. So by the time of World War One, he'd had about a 14, 15-year career. And, of course, there's no question that he's going to get some sort of assignment into the combat. He was, as Kevin had mentioned, he was with the 42nd Infantry Division. He was a brigade commander as a young brigadier general. And MacArthur being MacArthur, he always felt like the rules didn't quite apply to him. Though most all officers who were in the trenches would wear helmets, MacArthur disdained that and wore a cap, wore the scarf that Kevin had talked about. And there's this sort of popular memory of him when we think about his World War One record as this sort of incredible hero who was so, you know, fabulously decorated and did all these remarkable feats. If you actually really look at his record, he was a competent and certainly, you know, fairly brave guy, but not all that different than a lot of the other decent commanders in the war. MacArthur was in a position to award himself medals. And so this is one of the reasons why he comes out of the war so decorated. He didn't, if you really look at a lot of the 42nd Division soldier accounts, he didn't make all that much of an impression on them in a personal sense, but he certainly served competently. But this idea of a myth around MacArthur cultivating this aura will stay with him his whole career. And he also had, there's no question, he had an incredible intellect, and he was a person you didn't forget. He had this ability to recall details and to expound on any sort of event. He was the kind of person who monopolized conversations his entire life. So he did this even with superiors. And so that, in addition to his pedigree, is one of the things that leads him into a very, you know, successful post-war career, too.
Tell us about Montgomery, Kevin.
Montgomery, the British field marshal?
That's the guy.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to tell you another story. I want to tell you about John J. Pershing inspecting the 1st Infantry Division when it first arrived in Europe. And he was very disgusted with what he saw, the conditions of the soldiers, their equipment. And when it was over, he turned in front of the 1st Infantry Division, in front of all these men, he turns to the commanding officer and starts chewing him out about the way his division looks. And a captain breaks ranks, walks up to Pershing, and says, basically, listen, you have no idea the deprivations we have been putting up with just getting over here and getting started. You have no right to criticize us in this way. And Pershing looks at him and he says, well, you know, we have to deal with these shortages at headquarters, too. And the captain snapped back. He goes, yes, but we have to deal with them every day. And one soldier in the crowd turned to the other and said, boy, that George C. Marshall just signed his own death warrant. Nothing's going to happen with him in his career. However, Pershing realized this was an officer who was willing to speak truth to power and makes Pershing one of his aides. And Pershing is basically going to design the operations for the American armies through the rest of World War One, and then he's going to go on and become basically the architect of victory, the top military man right there at Roosevelt's elbow in World War Two.
And by the way, folks, Roosevelt was Secretary of Navy?
Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Okay, so he had something to do with submarine warfare, et cetera, and how to combat that. Is that right, John?
Well, in dealing with submarine warfare, the Navy is going to work with the Royal Navy on convoy techniques. And basically, you know, like the guard dog protecting a flock against a wolf kind of thing. Pretty soon, they're going to figure out there are ships called destroyers that are very good at hunting down and killing submarines. You have sonar come into play. And so the Royal Navy and the United States Navy are going to take about the first 8-9 months of the war to begin fully coordinating these kind of convoys. And, you know, and certainly Roosevelt has a hand in that, though he's not any sort of real tactician. He is a prominent politician who Wilson feels is an important person to place in the Navy Department for reasons beyond the military side. Franklin Roosevelt had no actual military experience, but he was a very competent administrator in the Navy Department during the war.
John, you mentioned Montgomery in your email to me. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Montgomery has, and you know, of course, he's not always that popular here in the United States. But you know, I'll speak on his behalf in this sense. Montgomery has a rather remarkable World War I record. He was a junior officer who spent, I would say, more time in the trenches and in combat in that war than most of the most of his American colleagues will have combat experience as a whole, taking into account World Wars One and Two. Montgomery was the kind of leader who led from the front, and this puts him in tremendous danger, as you would imagine. He was badly wounded during an attack, and I don't remember which one, but an anonymous attack in no man's land, you know, trying to overwhelm an enemy trench. Badly wounded, I believe, in the lung or the chest and abdomen area. It was so bad that he was pretty much just left for dead in no man's land. And it's almost an accident that, you know, the fighting calmed down and they were able to get to him and get him out of there, and that he was eventually able to recover. And then, you know, he returns to combat even after that when they're aware it seemed that he was probably going to die. And so the effect this has on Montgomery is he's very much loath to squander soldiers' lives. He had seen a lot of that in World War One. And so by World War Two, he felt that he understood and knew better than anybody how to lead attacks properly, that they must be properly planned, and that you don't squander your soldiers' lives, because he had seen so much of that, and he almost felt like he had gotten a second life. So Montgomery was really, for all of his bombast and egotism and vaingloriousness and all the rest of the things that we tend to disdain about him, Montgomery was a very human commander in that respect, and had high regard for the lives of his soldiers, whether they were British, American, or any other allied country.
Well, folks,
if I could just add, real quick about Montgomery, you know, John was talking about all the experience he had, yet you'd think that that would, you know, be a cause for a lot of respect from American commanders. But, you know, Patton would always stress, and the people that supported Patton would always say, well, you know, the guy never commanded tanks. He was always in the infantry in World War One. He doesn't know anything about tank warfare. So something he should have been revered for was actually used against him during the war.
Well, Kevin, tell us about Stilwell, General Stilwell.
General Stilwell was he was actually assigned to a French unit, to a machine gun unit, and so he spent his time in the trenches. But he learned French and French culture. He was considered a great ambassador of the United States with the French. And but after that, he's going to go off to China. And actually, he's going to go there with George C. Marshall. And so not only does he know English and French, but he learned Chinese while he's over there in the 1920s and early 30s. And when he comes back to the United States, he is rated the number one corps commander at the time of Pearl Harbor. So he is called to Washington. He's told he's going to lead the invasion of Africa, which is going to start at a place called Dakar. And he begins planning it and working on it. And at this time, they say, you know what, we got to make it. We have nobody in command in China, and we need someone, you know, high profile to deal with Chiang Kai-shek. And we think it should be you. What do you think? And he told the Secretary of War, he said, I'm a soldier. I'll go where I'm sent. But then he turned to his staff and said, oh, for the love of God, find somebody else. You know, I really want to do this. But when the Secretary of War realized that he was the most qualified, he went back to him a second time and said, really, you know, what would you say if we offer this? And he said, hey, I'm a soldier. I go where I'm sent. And so because of that, he is sent to China, spends much of his war in a very frustrating position as the military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek and the leader of any and all Americans in the China-Burma-India theater. And it's a job that does not play well to his strengths. He does have some prejudices, surprisingly a lot with the British, but a real solid combat soldier and a real soldier's general. And it's sort of put in a position that did not highlight his strengths. But once again, there's a prominent World War II commander that got his start in the trenches in World War I.
Now, I'm going to add a little story, and either Kevin, you or John, comment on this. In doing my research, since I think this is a very interesting story, that Adolf Hitler was in the German army, and he was in the trenches, and he was gassed. And as the gas was coming in the trenches, and they were yelling, and put on your gas mask, Adolf put on his gas mask, but it wouldn't seal, and he was getting gas. It came underneath his mask because he had a mustache. So right after that, sick as he was, he took out a knife and shaved off his mustache to the little portion that we see under his nose today in all of the photographs. What? And that's how that came to be. Is that true? Tell us, which one of you guys want to handle that? Nope, nobody?
John, you want to jump on that? I think the same thing happened to Charlie Chaplin.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Very.
I'll tell you what I can say, that, you know, he was a good soldier. He earned the Iron Cross for his actions in World War One. Very upset with Germany's defeat, obviously, even though he wasn't a German. But it's that he kind of embodies the embitterment of the German population with the defeat of World War One, and he's going to ride that humiliating defeat into office and into power in Germany. And you know, and then the rest of the story, I guess you could say.
Yeah, Hitler certainly had a reputation as a brave soldier, and in fact, at the end of the war, he had been a victim of a British gas attack, but the actual recorded formal reason as to why he was hospitalized was hysterical blindness, which is a byproduct of combat fatigue. And so Hitler had seen an awful lot of action, and I think one of his biographers, Ian Kershaw, put it best. He said, Hitler wouldn't be possible without World War One. In other words, his rise, his political career of any kind. So he's a product of World War One. His worldview is so powerfully shaped by his experiences in the trenches. And, of course, the political forces that are unleashed by World War One make Hitler's ascent not inevitable, certainly, but very possible. So World War One is a kind of a watershed event. In fact, you know, they used to call it the Great War to the generation that fought it. It was the worst war that humanity had ever experienced to that point in time. Unfortunately, a much worse war comes along later on as a kind of chapter two, World War II. But yeah, Adolf Hitler's wartime experiences are really rather fascinating, too, in the sense that he had a number of close calls, and you just wonder how history would have been different if he hadn't walked to one side of the trench and a shell, explodes on the other side kind of thing.
Yes, and that's the same with Mussolini, who was also in World War One. But the things that I read about Mussolini, he was vicious and he was violent, and he shot prisoners that were unarmed, and he was just a real nasty guy. So there were a lot of folks that were coming out, a lot of guys that were coming out of World War One and coming into prominence. But here's one, John, that you put down, and I'd never heard of, and I want you to comment on it because I want to know about Clarence Huebner.
Yeah, Clarence Huebner was a self-made guy who started as a school teacher and a football coach and decides he wants to join the Army. This is before the war. He joins as a private soldier, ascends to the highest NCO ranks, gets a commission in 1916. He's assigned to the 1st Division, you know, the big red one, as initially a platoon leader, then a company commander, then a battalion commander, then a regimental commander. And he serves in the trenches in combat as much as or more than any other officer I'm aware of in the United States Army in that war. He's badly wounded, lucky to survive, gets the Distinguished Service Cross. And he's better known, though, for his World War II experience in command, commanding the Big Red One, from Sicily all the way through the Normandy invasion and then becoming a corps commander because he was so effective. He's promoted from there. Clarence Huebner, I think, sort of is the emblem of the sort of mid-level American officer corps in World War One that learns a lot to become a very good general in World War II. And he's, you know, a lot of his leadership philosophy is formed at the time. So in a way, he's kind of the American version of Montgomery in the sense of having logged a lot of combat time, lucky to survive, and ends up leading troops really effectively in World War II.
Wow, was that, how was that, folks, the last 40 minutes? That was pretty exciting stuff, and I think we're going to put a little halt at this point on our historical spot and come back to this at another program, but I want John and Kevin, I'm going to give them just about, what do we got, Nina, three minutes? Yeah, she's shaking her head, well, 3 to 2. Kevin, tell us about some books that you wrote, especially photographs of from General Patton. Tell us about that.
Patton Photographs, my book about the photographs that Patton took during World War II, and there's a sidebar in the chapter on France about the meeting of MacArthur and Patton in World War I. I did about 2 years of research. That was originally a paper I gave at a historical society because so many myths had grown out of that, so I condensed them. The other book is Patton Legendary Commander, which I co-wrote with Martin Blumenson, and I just want to say happy birthday to Nancy, John's wife, today.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. You're very thoughtful, Kevin.
I really am.
Well,
I tell you,
we give a big Veterans Radio birthday to your wife, John. John, you've got Alamo and the Ardennes and September Hope. You've got about 2 minutes. Tell us about those.
Yeah, Alamo and the Ardennes is all about the fight in front of Bastogne in the first 3 to 4 days of the German offensive we know as the Battle of the Bulge. And, of course, Bastogne is vitally important as a town, you know, an objective for both sides, but it's the battle, I argue, is really decided in those first few days during the race for Bastogne, and there are units like the 28th Infantry Division, elements of the 9th and 10th Armored Division that buy time for the 101st, the more famous 101st, to get to Bastogne and then help hold it. So Alamo and the Ardennes is all about that, really, from the soldier's point of view, almost told in a kind of a minute-by-minute format. September Hope is all about Operation Market Garden, which had happened before the Battle of the Bulge, and it's an attempt by the Allies to have a joint airborne armor operation through Holland to knife through the German lines, hopefully get to Berlin and collapse the Nazi regime. It's unfortunately a terrible failure. We call it a bridge too far after the famous movie and book. So September Hope tells us the story of the American experience, the two airborne divisions, the 82nd and the 101st. And my more recent books, one is called The Dead and Those About to Die, The Big Red One in Omaha Beach, which is one of the reasons why I mentioned Clarence Huebner, because he's a prominent person in that particular book, which is all about the 1st Division in their fight in D-Day. And then go ahead.
We got the band now. The orchestra just got up and they're getting started. We're going to be John, Kevin, thank you very much for being our guest. This is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. Until next week, you're dismissed.